And I want to start by writing down the energy level diagram. And so, as Ian told you, we have this collection of electron spins. And we end up with this funny piece of saying that we have a spin one electron. And of course, electrons don't come in that flavor. So what we have is two electrons with a very strong exchange interaction, and they will go into the triplet and singlet manifold. And so then we have here the MS equals 1 in minus 1 levels. And so, of course, 2 spins up, 2 spins down. And we have this symmetric combination of up and down. And then what makes this a nice system is that there's an electronic excitation. And the electronic excitation is going to preserve the spin state, which is a fairly common thing, actually. And so to go from here to here, that difference is a red photon. And it'll be the same here because, of course, these energy differences are really tiny. This is the zero field splitting. And the zero field splitting simply says I have two electrons and I have a strong exchange coupling. And this is the strength of the exchange coupling. So no magic there. But we like to call it something else to confuse people. So we have 3 gigahertz here. And there could be a small separation between the plus and minus one energy levels. And that depends upon did we apply a magnetic field or not. Now, if I excite this, and the way we're going to do it is we'll take a laser, and although I told you that it's red, we're going to take a green laser. It's not just that we're colorblind. And what we'll do is we'll shine that down through a lens and into a focal spot. And I'm going to ask a few things of this lens. One, that it images a pinhole. So I'm going to put a pinhole here. And no, I don't want it like that. I want it like this. So it's not a very good diagram. It should be expanding all the way. But we'll image a pinhole. And I'm going to put another pinhole here. And this pinhole will be in front of a detector. Which is just a single photon detector. This mirror is going to be dichroic. And what it means is that green light is going to go this way. Red light, which we're emitting, goes this way. This focal spot is in our sample. And if I moved the pinholes around, I would change the location of the focal spot. And so what we do is we arrange these two pinholes so that the focal spots for red and green are at the same place. And then we say, well, we have a confocal arrangement instead of focal. And then I will translate my diamond around so that I can image. And we'll arrange that within this focal spot, which is about 1 micrometer cubed. There's only one defect. We can prove that. But I haven't showed you how just yet. Yeah? Okay. So here's our energy level diagram. And we excite with green light. That means I excite up here somewhere. And it will quickly fall down into this manifold. And as it does that, it won't change the spin stick. Yeah, you have a question.
Avalanche.
And would you mind repeating what you said about
this
being a
green focal? Yeah. So you see there's two different colors. There's the green that we're exciting with and the red that we're detecting. And both of them are controlled by a pinhole and an objective. So they both come to a focal spot. And what I want is, of course, the excitation from the green to be in the same focal spot that I'm collecting light from the red. Yeah. And if, I didn't say it, but of course we want a focal spot so that if we're exciting, the probability that we send a photon to the defect is higher. And if we're detecting, that there's any probability at all that we collect a photon. And of course the detection's a drag because the detection is a point source. So the detection is everywhere. And the lens lets us capture some of that light. But of course, a small fraction of it. Okay. So what happens is we excite. It falls down to this manifold. And then if it's in the zero state, it'll decay to the zero state. And it'll do that with a time constant. That's roughly 20 nanoseconds. If it's in the plus or minus one state, it'll decay to the plus or minus one state. So if it's in plus one, it'll decay only to plus one. If it's in minus one, it'll decay only to minus one. And the time constant is about the same. But remember that we had the singlet state over here. And the singlet state is separated from the triplet state because the two electrons are identical. But this is a solid state system. And in solid state, no selection rule ever works. Okay? So then we say, oh, well, if I was looking at an operator which is sigma x plus sigma x. So now I'm thinking about two electron spins, not in this one. Then, of course, under this operator, if I calculated the transition probabilities with Fermi-Golden rule, they're absolutely zero. But that won't be really what's happening. What happens is we get sigma x, I'll put a prime there, plus 1 minus epsilon sigma x prime. Right, there'll be a slight difference because you're interacting with the rest of the lattice, and the rest of the lattice makes itself known to those electrons. Under this case, the plus or minus one transitions can transition to the singlet state. Nicely, so it's a nice homework problem. Under this, there still is no transition from MS equals zero. Okay, so the only thing that can happen is that from the plus or minus one states, you can go over to the singlet state. So we can go this way, and it happens one third of the time. It's a so-called intersystem crossing. And from here, it gets complicated, but you don't need to know it. Here, 100% of the time, 92% of the time, but for us 100% of the time. It decays to the zero state, and it does that with a lifetime of 300 nanoseconds. And now you can see some nice things. That if I want to prepare the MS equals zero state, all I need to do is to turn on the laser. Because if I'm in the zero state, then I'll just cycle back and forth to the zero state. If I'm in the MS equals one state, well, I'll cycle back and forth between these, except a third of the time I'll come over here, and always I'll decay to the zero state. And then, of course, I would just cycle in the zero state, right? So simply by turning on the laser and waiting, well, you need to wait a time long compared to 300 nanoseconds, you've prepared the MS equals zero state. So here we get state preparation very nicely. Now, these states emit photons. They're radiative. This process occasionally emits a photon, but it's at such a wildly different energy, we'll never see it. It'll never couple into our experiment. So here we have photons coming out. And if we plot the counts versus time, so we have a state. Time means I turn on the laser and I start counting. And you can see the nice thing now. Here, I'm turning on a green laser, but I'm counting in the red. And so this is the reason that we make this above the energy, so that I never get a green photon over to my APD. So I can leave the laser on while I'm counting in principle. So, okay, we count. And if I'm in the MS equals zero manifold, well, it just cycles. So we just keep getting photons out over and over and over again. But if I'm in the plus or minus one manifold, then the initial rate is going to be two-thirds of the slope of the MS equals zero, because one-third of the time it'll end up over here. But of course, if it ends up over there, it will then emit photons as though it was the MS equals zero. And so the MS equals one state will have a smaller number. And you can see that there's an optimum. If I keep counting too long, the difference between the counts for the zero and one state would become smaller and smaller. If I take the ratio to the total number. So there's an optimum of where I can get the best. And I'm not sure I told you, but although there's a slight energy difference between the photon that's given off in the zero state and in the plus minus one state, those differences are too small. We don't bother to try to measure them. You know, if that was your goal in life, you can measure it, but we don't do it. Okay. Now, we said that this system in our confocal volume has one defect. And since it has one defect, it better look like a single photon emitter. And we can test that by taking this detector and replacing it with a half-silvered mirror and two detectors. And a coincidence counter. So it's a nice experiment described best by Glauber. But it really could be thought about in a perfectly classical way. So-called Hanbury-Brown twist experiment. Says I have one photon coming in. And if I have one photon, then only one detector better click. Right? It's the whole principle of the thing. And so what I do is I measure the coincidences as a function of this time delta t. because I need to get the timing right. And once you've put everything together, this arm is not going to be exactly the same length as that. The electronics are not exactly the same. And so I vary this time delta t, and I look at the coincidence counts. And if there's only one, if there's only a single photon detector, then when I adjust delta t so that the single photon, if it took this path or if it took this path, would arrive at the detector at exactly the same amount, same instance, then of course we see a dip and you can prove that, yes, you have a single photon emitter. All right, good. Now the nice thing about this NV system is it's coherent at room temperature. It doesn't need strong magnetic fields. It's nice and compact. You can make the whole thing bloody small if you want to. And you have a few qubits, right? So that here we've looked at just the electron. But Ian showed you that these energy levels would be split by the nitrogen spin. And most interestingly, they'd be split by any C13s that you have. And you can control to some extent how many C13s you have at a center. So let's look at a simple experiment to illustrate our control of these things. So I'm going to take my diamond and I'm going to allow it to have one C13. So an electron, one C13. I'm going to forget that there's a nitrogen there. The nitrogen is always there, but it's not so much fun to play with. And so if we take this system and we cool it, which means I turn the laser on for a microsecond, then the electron will be in the zero manifold, and the carbon spin will be equally polarized up or down. And again, lousy notation, but I'm going to leave it that way. And then I can swap those two. And put that information there, and you saw that the way we would do that is to use the hyperfine interaction, the fact that there's a magnetic-magnetic interaction between the electron and the nuclear spin. And then I can cool again, so I end up now with fine nomenclature in a pure state that they're both in the zero state. And let's rotate the electron into some arbitrary state. And correlate them. So let's just apply a controlled knot. And so we'll apply the control on the electron and we'll knot the carbon. So we have a state which is potentially entangled depending on our choice of alpha and beta. Okay. I take this state and I measure the electron spin. So what do I find? Was that? Fantastic. So I find that the electron spin is zero with a probability alpha squared, and it's one with a, and, you know, I'll just leave it like that, with a probability beta squared. Okay. And what about the nuclear spin? Yeah. I'm sorry, again.
Likewise, it can measure independently.
Thank you. So if
I measure this, then I say, oh, yes, that I'm in the state one, zero, or I'm in the state one. But now I've detected the electron spin, which means I turned on the laser. So what are the two states that I would find after the measurement? Okay, almost. So we've turned on the laser. And so if we turn on the laser, then always the electron spin is going to end up in the zero manifold. So we'll end up in the state, zero, zero. And we'll have those probabilities, yeah? So now I'm going to take this state, I'm going to apply a controlled NOT gate again. I'm going to apply a controlled NOT gate where I'm going to control on the carbon and not the electron. And so out of this, we'll end up with those states. And now I make a measurement again. What do I find? So I can interpret that in two ways, one of which I'll be happy with and one that I won't be. So give me three sentences and expanding on that. Okay, not quite happy. So I want you to say something about a conditionality here.
All right. This is conditional on you not having, what I just said is conditional on you not having measured before. If you did measure before, then you should get the same thing that you measured before.
Thank you. So the first measurement with these probabilities, we'll go down one of those two paths. And then having done that, with unit probability, we will learn that we have the same state. And again, we will reset the system. And we can cycle these things back. And we can repeat the measurement as many times as we like, well, until the carbon spin loses its state, until there's a T1 process that causes the carbon spin to lose its identity, right? There's no coherence. It's just a T1 process here. Now, if I take all of those outcomes and I've added them up, no, let me put it differently. If I want to make an expectation value measurement, remember that we only have one NV center, how do I have to make an expectation value measurement? Yeah, so repeat the whole thing, right? So I need to go all the way back here and repeat from here a bunch of times to make an expectation value. Even though I can cycle through here 100 times, that we can do experimentally. And that's very useful. It gives us a lot more signal to noise. It, in fact, doesn't give us any additional information about what the expectation value is. Good. All right. So now, what I'd like to do is to think about the NV in terms of making a quantum processor. Actually, let's do this way. this is useful, that's not so useful. So now we have our quantum processor, and we can say, well, should DaVincenzo be happy? And we can initialize, that's no problem. We certainly have universal gates. We can measure. So all of these things were great. Decoherence. It's okay, it's not great. As with many solid-state systems, there's a lot of other defects. You know, it's nice to say, oh, I can take a 1 micron cubed area and have only one defect. But what I really mean by that is I have only one defect that's emitting light at this color, right? And certainly, if I look within a cubic micron, there are 10 to the 12 atoms. There'll be more than one atom out of place, right? And so decoherence is good, but it's not great. And of course, you know, it's somewhat in our control. A scalable mapping to qubits. Well, sure, it's scalable to 3. So what we need to do is to find a way of connecting NV centers. And I want you to think about this for your tutorial. So take 2 NV centers. Now, one way of doing this is simply to have 2 NV centers that are close enough that the electron-electron interaction separates those two, so that I can see an energy shift of this electron, whether this one's up or down. Okay? And that's not a particularly powerful thing to do. You can do it, but I don't like it that much. And it doesn't lend itself to any nice physics. So instead, let's put in here a 2-level fluctuator. And you might know that when you build superconducting devices, you see these beautiful noise from 2-level fluctuators. And then you go and you say, well, let me investigate that. So I'm going to put a little bit of coherence in that 2-level fluctuator. Turns out that generally those 2-level fluctuators are more coherent than the device you're trying to work with. And so here we say, oh, we know we'll have 2-level fluctuators. Let's go and try to couple 2 NVs by a 2-level fluctuator. And the way you want to think about this is that you have a spin 1/2 particle that can be here or here. And of course, it can be in 2 states. And so let's draw an energy level diagram. So we have a double well potential that the electron could be here, it could be there. Of course, it could be in a coherent superposition of both. That it's enough to have 2 levels in each well. And they're split by some Zeeman energy. And you want to give yourself another degree of freedom. So let's give ourselves another degree of freedom of putting on an electric field. So with an electric field, of course, I can tilt the potential any way I like because this electron, in fact, has charge. And so we could say, well, what is this? Well, it could be 2 quantum dots. Or it could be a spin chain in the first excitation manifold. Okay? It could be, in fact, a fluctuating molecule, that you have molecules that only allow 2 states. Take a benzene ring. It wants to flip. It doesn't want to be halfway around. It could be a magnon in a magnetic domain. And for all of this, you don't need the magnon physics to find the interesting piece, right? So we forget magnons and say, okay, I have an electron that can be close to this NV or close to that NV. It's coherent, it has an energy level, and you can control it. And of course, we could imagine higher energy levels. I don't think they'll help you. But you know, if you think so, don't let me get in your way. And here, of course, we're saying that there's a dipolar interaction between these things. And we'll say that there's no dipolar interaction between those. And again, you could put more than one electron in the system, but if you put just one electron, you'll be able to obtain full control of coupling those two NV centers. Okay? And the nice thing to try to learn is, what do you need out of such a simple model to have good coupling between these? Another nice piece that you might think about is, imagine you were going to lay NVs out on some sort of grid. If these two NVs are exactly the same, then the fact that I put the electron here differentiates those two, because it shifts it by the dipolar energy. And then I could selectively address this NV without addressing that one. So in addition to having this two-level system giving a mechanism for exchanging information between the two NVs, you could also use it to spatially identify the two NVs and to break your system from having a collection of identical NVs to a collection of controlled qubits. Yep. Good. So I leave that for your tutorial. Any questions on that? Yeah. You're saying, why don't we do this in the lab already? You know, I do imagine them in the same confocal spot. You know, the confocal spot's a micron. And, you know, that might as well be a kilometer for the dipolar coupling, right? There is some interesting physics that you guys could look at some other time. Of saying, imagine I collected a photon from two NVs in two different focal spots. Could I post-select on an outcome to entangle those two? And those sorts of experiments have been done. They're very inefficient, and particularly because when a photon leaves an NV, there's a recoil, and so the diamond knows where that photon came from. And this is very different than in the neutron case. Right? In the neutron case, we had the same argument that there was some momentum left in the blade. But the neutron's interacting as a plane wave over that blade. And so it's left as a really small change of a thermal state. And so there's no the overlap of the input and output states is effectively one. Here, that's not the case. Yep. Yeah?
So you manufacture your diamond.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have control over where the NV centers go?
So you can control the NV, where the NVs are. Not as well as we would like to. It's usually not... If you're growing a diamond, then you can control somewhat the plane at which you have NVs. But a little bit more nicer than that is to take a beam of nitrogen atoms or ions and accelerate them into the diamond. And since you can define the energy of those very precisely, you can define the depth at which they'll be implanted very precisely. And if you put a mask over the diamond, then you can have areas where you exclude a nitrogen from being implanted. Now, you can't guarantee that in the holes of your mask there will be a nitrogen, right? But you can guarantee that in places where you've masked, there won't be a nitrogen. And so you can have some control over where you place these.
So, no scheme that we come up with to put many of these centers together can rely heavily on sort of their spatial relationships?
So the way that that this is done today is to go and image where the NVs are. We can do that quite accurately. And then if I want to put a one-dimensional chain of spins here, then we'd say, oh, I'll just fine tune and we'll put a nanotube or some other, a ribbon of graphene or, you know, some other imaginative thing there. So that's still a work in progress of how to engineer these things. And wasn't a piece of what I was imagining. So what I was hoping you would do is to say, oh, take the distances as fixed as what's convenient for you and go ahead and do it. But they, you know, it is nice to think about these, where the real problems are in manufacturing and if you have clever ideas, they would help. Yeah? Okay. Good. So now then, I want to spend just a little bit of time telling you about a related system where we can check these things as well. So we're still going to look at an electron nuclear spin system. And the example I want to use is triphenylmethane. So this central carbon has only three bonds. Of course, carbon likes to have four bonds. And so there's an electron that hangs out here. So there's a stable free electron. So in this case, that's perfectly a spin 1/2 electron. And this molecule, we can arrange to make a crystal of it. And the crystal is one molecular layer thick. So there's a technique called the Langmuir-Blodgett film, where you take molecules, you suspend them on top of a liquid, and you come with a paddle and you squeeze them until they form a crystal, and then you stop. And it was developed in the 1920s, and it really works. So we have these molecules, and so we end up with a crystal structure. And so the crystal structure, the piece of it that I want to pay attention to is a 4x4 block out of that big crystal. So the crystal goes on forever, but we're going to look at this 4x4 block. And out of this 4x4 block, I want to, each molecule is exactly the same. So I want to have a way that I can distinguish the molecules from each other. So I'm going to take four of the nuclear qubits. So in these places, put carbon 13. And you can do that by chemistry. It's not particularly challenging. And so I have four C13s, and I'm going to use these as bits, not qubits. So I'm going to prepare them in their eigenstate, so either in the ground state or the spin-excited state, okay? And since there's four of them, then I have 16 possibilities, right? So now you can see why I would have 16 molecules here, etc., right? And if you look at this, let's remember the Hamiltonian. Now, the Hamiltonian here is just about the same Hamiltonian there, except we don't have a zero field splitting. And so the Hamiltonian says that I have some frequency of the electron spin plus I'm going to build it up slowly, but let me call that A because there'll be other terms. Here we have the ZZ part of the hyperfine interaction. Remember, the hyperfine interaction had two pieces to it. It had the piece that was a Fermi contact piece, which says polarize the bonds via the nuclear states. And it has the piece, which is the through space dipole-dipole. But I just want this piece. Now look at what happens. If I fix the state of the nuclear spins, so if I fix this to either plus 1/2 or minus 1/2, then I modify the frequency of the electron spin by the value of the hyperfine splitting. And I will tell you that the hyperfine frequency of all of those C13s are different. And so what we end up doing is we end up by setting those spins to a particular value. We create an effective shift of the electron spin so that each electron spin over this grid has its own resonance frequency. So now then, although these two are chemically indistinguishable, from the electron spin point of view, they're distinct. Okay, so we have that piece. Now I still need qubits. So I'm going to take those six nuclei. I'm going to use those as qubits. And here, we're going to have, of course, this term, plus we'll have Zx in our control terms. But you can see that for each molecule, we'll have six qubits. There's 16 molecules, and so we have 96 qubits in this tile. Now the processor is a 2D array of these tiles. So everything we're doing is an expectation or is it an ensemble measurement, right? We have many, many, many copies. We have 10 to the 11 or 10 to the 12 copies, right? But each of these processors will have 96 qubits. And of course, if I'm looking in the corner here, and I would look at the interaction this way, or look at the interaction this way, I can tell that those are leaving the tile, right? That if I'm looking at the 0000 state, I'm only going to allow myself to interact between those molecules. And because I've labeled all of those frequencies and the tile's big enough, I know what's in the tile and what's out of the tile. Good. Now I need to tell you two more things to make you, to convince you that this is in fact a more interesting quantum processor. The first we need to do is to keep in track here. The electron spin, that's what's controlling everything, just as Ian said yesterday. These nuclear spins, those are labels. These are qubits. But although these are qubits, everything's controlled by the electron spin. So the electron spin, we need to prepare the nuclear spins, we need to control the gates, we need to measure via the electron spin. But as we do that, we never want coherence on the electron spin, because the electron spin has the biggest magnetic moment, so the electron spin is the noisiest piece in this system. It's still very quiet, but it's the noisiest. So I want to polarize the electron spin. In order to do that, we place the whole device on a superconductor. So we have a superconducting resonator. That has a quality factor of about 15,000. It's coupled to 10 to the 12 copies of an electron spin. And here I want to just think about this as, let's say I'm talking about this electron spin. Okay, so we have many copies of this electron spin. The resonator we can cool. So the resonator we can put in its ground state or very near to its ground state. And I can create a coupling between these two. And the coupling has this outrageously large value of 5 hertz, which you would say, hey, I don't want to wait around a second every time I want to do something on my computer. But fortunately, the rate of cooling here goes, because we have 10 to 12 copies, the rate of cooling goes as the square root of n times g for an initial rate. As I want to cool this, and so what do? Let's look in frequency, which would be the same thing as energy, right? So I have my cavity here, and it has this high Q. And then over here, I have my spins. I'm going to excite the spins with the Rabi drive. I'm just going to rotate them. As I'm rotating them, of course, I'm driving them with photons. And I'm going to arrange that this difference is equal to the Rabi frequency. So I'm driving here, but since I'm driving with the Rabi frequency, there's a sideband that sits over here. And those photons, they want to be in the cavity, right? The cavity, they can live a long time. They can go bouncing back and forth 15,000 times. In free space, they get one round. So they want to jump into the cavity, but they have the wrong energy. So what do? They steal energy from the spin system and jump into the cavity. So you get a term that looks like sigma XA plus. And the cavity heats up, the spin system cools down. And fortunately, we can keep cooling the cavity. And since it goes as a square root of n, the rate that we can polarize this is a few microseconds. And so we can turn on a field, and when we want to cool the spins, we turn on a field and they cool. When we don't turn on that field, they don't cool. So we leave them alone, then we say, oh, now I want some cold spins. Let me turn on the field. Okay. Now there's one more piece that we need to show you. So here we say we can cool. There we say we have universal control over a molecule. Okay? Here we say we have something which is not scalable, but it gets us up to 100 qubits, and that's not so bad for today. And now then I need to get information from one molecule to the next molecule. Okay. So here's how I'm going to do it. We have an electron and an electron. And for now, let's let each electron only have one nuclear spin. Okay? It'll be no different, you'll see, if it has 10 nuclear spins. But one will be nice for now. So here, we have the hyperfine interaction. And here, we have a dipole-dipole coupling. But now this is a dipole-dipole coupling of one electron spin to another electron spin. So this dipole coupling looks just like the other dipole couplings as a term that's sigma dot sigma minus 3 sigma z sigma z. Okay? And if I wanted, so what I want to do is I want to take and apply a gate between these. But the dipolar coupling between the nuclear spins, remember the nuclear spins, the magnetic moment is 1,000 times weaker than the electron spin. So if I was going to rely upon the nuclear spins, we're down by 6 orders of magnitude. Seems like a drag. So let's draw up the energy level diagrams and see what we can do. I have the nuclear spins. Like so. And of course, then I need to think about the electron spin. But remember, the electron spin doesn't carry any information. We want the electron spin to be cold and there to be no coherence on the electron spin. So we would like the electron spin to be 0, 0, or down, down, if you like. And of course, if I want to create a gate between these, the only gate I need to worry about is this one right here. Can I swap the states? Right? If I can do that, I'm golden. I can do everything. So let's worry about this. Now let's look at the two single excitation manifolds for this system. Now, what you would say, sort of a knee-jerk reaction here is to say, well, look, I have the hyperfine interaction, so why don't I swap here? And then I have the dipolar interaction, so why don't I swap here? And then I have the hyperfine interaction, so I could swap here. And then if I want to really swap the information, I need to go to the dipolar again and to the hyperfine. So if I wanted to have a swap gate, I could make it out of three operators that are local. Hyperfine swap, dipole swap, hyperfine swap, dipole swap, hyperfine swap. It would be done. But I want to find a shortcut to this, and I don't want to leave information on the electron spin, right? Because the electron spin is the noisiest thing in the system. So we look at the commutator of the dipole and the hyperfine. But remember that we use the hyperfine twice. Right? We go hyperfine, dipole, hyperfine. So the commutator that I want to look at is the second order commutator of the hyperfine in the dipole. And when I write out this piece, we come up with this lovely term. Where the first flip-flop is electron, the second one is nuclear. So we get this four-body term that comes out to that hyperfine interaction, out to that second commutator. And this thing is absolutely great, right? Because what does it do? It says, take me from here to here, or take me from there to there. Right? Connects those two. And so it connects from one nuclear spin to another nuclear spin. It allows a flip. But of course, we have to also have a flip of the electron spins. And I would like this thing to be the most important process in the system. And we can achieve that by driving these transitions. So we're going to go into an interaction frame. Whereby driving those transitions with a microwave field, then I average out all the other terms of the Hamiltonian. This becomes a leading term. And notice what happens. Information from here goes up, it goes over, it comes back down here. And so we get this coherent, continuous exchange of information. The other piece that's nice is the Rabi frequency is fast. And so what's really happening is information's oscillating back and forth here, and then slowly becoming that it's oscillating back and forth here. And so it's never living in this manifold. And if I plot the fidelity versus the Rabi frequency times the electron T1, that's the quantity I want. Okay? So when this is big, the fidelity is 1. And then we'll have a sigmoidal transition. And experimentally, we're over here somewhere at 10 to the 4. This happens at about 1. The other thing that you can recognize is that there was nothing about this process that restricted it to a single nuclear spin. That you could do all of this in parallel. And so if I was up here and I had two copies of this molecule, then all of these spins can be coupled in parallel. So I can exchange information across these very quickly. Okay? So this is how we're trying to make a piece which we can initialize, we'll have good gates, we'll have good measurement, we have very good decoherence. It's not scalable, but it's 100 qubits, you know? So we're not worried about that yet. It's also the first time that we could look in parallel at information at the removal of entropy. One of the challenges of making a quantum computer is get the entropy out of your system fast enough. And you have to do that in parallel. And since with the cooling process, during cooling, we can suppress the difference between the spins because it's just difference in a Hamiltonian. So that's under our control. And we can cool all the spins in parallel, or we could cool a subset. And we don't know what the right way to approach the problem is. We're still learning that. And we particularly don't know here the fact that this is the rate at which the spins start to cool. That's perfect. We know that. And we know that the last spin that flips goes as that rate. And how to connect those two? It's a nice multi-body problem that we can't solve. So if you want to join the group and solve that problem for us, you know, theoretically and experimentally, we'd be thrilled. Okay, so let's stop here. Tomorrow I'll tell you about superconductors quickly. And you have your tutorial. Any questions? Okay, thanks.